Okay, so now we're back then to this Science Citation Index in the beginning of your getting the grant from NIH. Talk about how this happened.
I told you, I got a letter from Dr. Lederberg in 1958, the year he won the Nobel Prize. And he asked in that letter, a copy of that letter is still available, what had happened to my idea of the citation index, which he had read in Science Magazine in 55. I wrote him a long letter telling him my various efforts to get the thing developed and that I was not able to get support from the National Science Foundation because I was not an institution, so forth.
Had you actually made some proposals to NSF?
Oh yeah, various proposals. Yeah. And a lot of those are in the files, different kinds of proposals. But to make a long story short, he then said that he thought that if I made an application for a grant to the National Institute of Health, that the genetic study section might take an interest in it. And he sent down, not he, but then the executive director of that study section came to see me. Two people, a woman, I think her name was Wilson, and the other was a Dr. Green, who was director of the Jackson Memorial Laboratory in Maine or something like that, Bar Harbor, Maine.
Mm-hmm.
And to make a long story short, they said at that time it was perfectly legitimate for a for-profit organization to apply for a grant or a contract with NIH. It was done quite regularly. So we negotiated the project. I got an NIH contract, okay, a grant for $50,000 a year for 3 years.
Let me just stop a sec. Was the same thing possible from NSF? Did
no.
they have contracts?
They
NSF
did not. To my knowledge, they would. They may have had service contracts, but they did not give out research grants to that way.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
At least I had been told I could not. I was on when I got rid of when I came out of the project. Helen Brownson once said to me later on, "Oh, why didn't you come to me?" And I said, "Well, I was an unaffiliated individual. You don't give grants to individuals." No. And I don't even know, to this day, you probably couldn't get it. If you as an individual apply for a grant to the NSF, I don't think you can get a grant. You have to be affiliated with an organization, a nonprofit.
But by 56, you had your own company, though. But they must have had
not when I was first left. Well, when I left the Welch Project, I was an unaffiliated individual. And
okay.
She said to me, "Why didn't you come to me?" I said, "What do you mean? What was I going to sell you? What did I have to offer you?" So I have to go and get myself connected first.
Yeah.
So what happened was that they got the grant, we got the contract, we had an advisory committee of a dozen scientists, geneticists were on the committee, and we went ahead and proceeded. But then, right in the middle of the project, a congressman from North Carolina named Congressman Fountain got very upset about a grant that had been given to a for-profit group in New England somewhere where the guys had done some, I don't know, unethical things with the money, whatever. And a rule was established at NIH that they would no longer have grants for anything but nonprofit. And that all existing grants had to be converted to contracts. Okay? And don't ask me why, but they then, what they did, the way they got around it was they took the remaining money on the grant and transferred that to the National Science Foundation. And they negotiated a contract to complete the project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And So we went on, and as a result of the contract, we produced the genetic citation index, which is sitting up there. And but in order to produce the genetic citation index project, we had to produce the data for the 1961 SCI. And I...
So part of the agreement was not only genetics, but you would cull genetics out of all of the science?
We had to extract it from the SCI.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So we had the data for the SCI, covering 600 and some odd journals completely, over 100,000 articles, as I recall. And I went to the NSF and I said, look, we distributed the genetics. Let's do the same thing with the SCI. And they would not hear of it. They would not pay for printing and distributing the SCI.
Who is this?
NSF.
No. Oh, what person?
Burton Atkinson, among others.
Helen okay. Brownson was gone.
Yeah, they were still there.
Okay.
Whoever was there. So I then had to make the decision, either to toss the data out or let it slide and go about continuing with current contents, or launch a citation index service. So we made the decision to go with a quarterly index. And the first quarter of 1964 was produced and printed in the middle of 65, I guess.
What was the
60,
first?
Oh, I'm sorry,
first
64.
First issue of SCI?
Was a quarterly.
In what year? What month, I mean?
January to March.
Of covering?
Quarterly. A quarterly.
Well, I'm actually just trying to get at the date that the first...
January to March of 1964.
January to March of 64.
And we put it in a hardcover, too.
Okay. But now that was the period of that the literature covered. So it actually appeared in, say, what month? That's what I was trying to get.
It came out in the spring of 94.
Of 64.
Yeah, 64.
Okay. That's what I was trying to get. Now, the issue of genetic citation index was...
That covered the literature of 1961. The other thing, we published... Oh, wait a minute. We also published the 1961 SCI completely.
Right. When did that appear? That's what I was...
That came out in...
63. And so did GCI of July
yes.
of 63.
Right.
Did they appear not quite simultaneously?
We did the the 91. We sold it for $500, 61. And then we also announced, because what's the point of having 1 year? We announced a continuation of the service. And we said, let's make it current.
Okay, that's what. So GCI is about July of 63.
Yeah.
And 61 SCI is when?
Winter of... Have it here.
I'm just trying to nail these down precisely.
It's been here. First printing, July 63.
That's GCI.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I have that.
You'd have to look it up in a catalog. Somewhere.
Okay, I'll have to check that out. Yeah.
I'm sure it exists. Library of Commerce.
Well, they're going to have the coverage probably and not the actual date. Probably have to go and find the first issue. I was hoping you had the first issue of SCI, but don't. Okay. So what was your financial status when you made that decision?
To do what?
To publish SCI.
We were publishing current contents, and we were making a profit on current contents.
You've called it the most risky decision.
Yeah.
Were you borrowing money right at the very beginning to do
that?
No,
I don't think so.
You had enough cash flow to do that? Or money in the bank?
I think so. And remember, you're dealing with subscription publications, you get payment in advance. So that advance, well, let's say if we took, it was $500 a year, I guess. If you got 100 subscriptions, you have $50,000 to play with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How were subscriptions that first year?
They weren't fast enough, obviously, so that we were draining money faster than we were taking it in. And so the decision to sell stock...
To borrow.
Borrow $500,000, uh-huh, must have been, was pretty evident. Yes, right. You could plot the trend of how much money we were taking in and how much money we were putting out to produce the product.
Yeah. Well, you may remember when I was talking with the folks.
Now, one of the decisions that we took in 64, or no, in 66, was that we would know we covered U.S. patents in the first 2 years. Okay, because we wanted to sell it to industry. The decision we took in 66 was, since we got so few subscriptions from industry, we canceled the coverage of the patents.
This must mean, then, that you were seeing most of your subscriptions from academic institutions.
Of course. I just told you, there were no industry subs.
Yeah. But government wasn't coming through with much?
Government doesn't account for all that much, generally, anyhow. Maybe a few. I think the first subscription was from the SCI, from the CIA. First, among, I think the first two or three, one was from China, and the other was from CIA and that sort of thing.
Really?
Yeah, amazing.
How were overseas subscriptions in the early years?
Some. You know, I mean, it was certainly 20%, maybe, of your business.
How'd you set the price?
I guess we figured the market would be, we thought we could, sell 500, I don't remember. At $500 a year, if we got 500 subscriptions, that would be $250,000, so we obviously thought we could produce it for that.
My first memory of SCI, and particularly SSCI, was the librarian showing it to me and saying how expensive it was.
Yeah.
So
you can imagine if somebody of those 61 volumes, six volumes was it, I think, for $500.
Yeah.
Big pill to swallow in those days for $100.
Yeah.
But the fact that they had all this information. Now that was another thing. You see, the whatever sales we made of that were had to pay for the printing and the processing, basically the printing. But we made enough probably to cover that and then launch the other.
Talk to me about how, and we as who, I mean, how many folks at the, and say, of middle of 63, 60, end of 63, how many folks are we talking about in the company?
I don't know. 50 to 100.
Yeah.
It's in order to do the citation work, and obviously have operators doing that.
A lot of these folks you had hired because you had the contract with NIH.
Yeah. Yeah. I honestly don't remember.
How big was that amount of money? I was trying to find that amount.
What?
With NIH.
We got a $50,000 a year grant.
50, okay. And you did it for the three-year period of time.
Afterwards, when they refused to publish the index, I was able to negotiate another contract with NSF to do a study of the coverage of indexing and abstracting services. So that was the way that we kept some of these people working. And I'm sure that we produced a report.
Yeah.
And it showed the gaps and overlaps between various indexing services and covering various articles. And I think we used our database to prove that.
Talk to me about how you were making decisions on input of this stuff into the computer and how these decisions were being made. Because we're talking about something that no one else has done at the time in terms of getting input done and output done in a way that was efficient. Who was making these decisions? Did you hire some programmers at the time?
Well, eventually we did, yeah. Well, we had, I have to remember when these people first came to work for us. Interesting. I mean, Irv Scher was here, and then we had a fellow named Phil Sapinski who became vice president of data processing. And we were using, we went punch cards, but we would use we would rent the mainframe computers down at the IBM Service Bureau.
Oh, yeah?
To do various things. Yeah, the 60s. And it wasn't until much later on that we got our own computers. So we were using service bureaus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you had some internal programming folks, since you must have contracted some.
No, I think we had... Irv Scher was involved in it.
Now what's his background?
Well, Irv Scher was a biochemist, but he was a mathematician. Fully understood programming and everything. He could program. Phil Sapinski was, from the old data processing days. And I guess you'd get an idea of these people if we knew what year they came to work for us, these programs. Some of them are still here.
Oh, are they really?
Yeah. Sure.
The thing that strikes me looking at...
We got a what they call the 10-year club. Next year, Beverly Bartolomeo is going to be a 40-year member.
Is that right?
Yeah,
wow.
This is her 40th anniversary.
What strikes me in looking at GCI is how much it physically resembles the page layout of the current SSCI and SCI. So decisions that were made now over 30 years ago, apparently we're pretty good, or at least they've stuck with you all, served you well.
We've considered a lot of alternative formats. We were well aware of the compromises we were making because of the space problem. Could have designed a much more informative format. We had unlimited space. And that's what you tend to have when you go to the new electronic formats. And now with the new Web of Science, it's going to be even better. You can go in and out of the source data, citation data, and so on.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I could show you, I think even in one of the indexes in there had a combined source and citation index. There's no reason why the two should be separated, except for space and, orientation. But you could look and see one combined index. Wasn't there one of the indexes? Wasn't it that way, or am I mistaken? They're all the same. Well, you see, what it did was it combined it in the sense that there were gaps. See, this tells you that this is a source item, but it was not cited.
Mm-hmm. Okay? Mm-hmm.
that later. Because you didn't have the source data there combined.
Yeah. Right?
So when you looked in this person's name, you got the full listing of his publications, even if it wasn't cited.
Did this system just kind of fall together? You all kept playing with all kinds of variations
of course,
on it?
Yeah.
And
lots and lots.
This was during the NIH contract that you...
Yeah. What kind of developmental research?
Other than yourself, to whom do you give the central credit for the development of the ideas in terms of how it was done?
Well, the implementation was Irv Schur.
Was it? He was the principal one on GCI. I noticed that you all jointly authored that or listed it.
Well, together, that was, he was I was running the company, and he made, we had long discussions. Irv was a very opinionated, strong-willed guy. And eventually, we worked it all out.
Mm-hmm. And you say he later was one of the folks who left the company and then came back?
Art influenced him to leave.
Mm-hmm. But came back?
He came back, yeah.
Uh-huh. And what's he doing now?
He died last year.
Okay.
Uh-huh. But he was working pretty close to the end.
Interesting.
He was director of quality control here, a big hole.
What have you done over the years in the way of marketing analysis of it and use studies of it? Have you done many studies of it?
I don't think you could say we did many. Well, it's pragmatics. You're running a business, unless you're making super huge, super profits, you don't really can't even afford that kind of a luxury. There are quite a few people outside of ISI that were studying certain aspects of it. I don't think that I could say that I'm satisfied that there were ever adequate number of studies done.
Yeah.
Even to this day. Did you get a copy of the paper I did on the synoptic history of...
Mm-hmm.
I say in there, there haven't been that many... there are a certain number of validation studies, there are a certain number of... But we don't know about the use. It's out there, people buy it. I mean, people make statements. If you read Hackstrom's paper, it was cited a while ago. He claims they did a study that 60% of faculty 60% of faculty evaluations were involved in the use of the
60%.
Yeah.
Wow.
How would I know that? They did the study and asked. But do you use citation analysis in any way, one way or another? So.
I know our folks do.
How they use it, how intelligently they use it, who knows?
Yeah. My own experience at one institution is that it gets mentioned pretty often in tenure reviews.
Yeah.
And in promotion reviews. Yeah.
Well, it should, but it depends on how it gets mentioned. See, a lot of people lump it together with all kinds of uses that are made. In other words, somebody gets a guy's name in for an evaluation, and they say, hey, what has this guy published? They go and look it up in the SCI. Well, so what does that tell you? Well, that's no different than looking it up in Chemical Abstracts or anything else, or asking a guy for a CV. But there are people who will tell you, I use the citation index to evaluate this guy.
Meaning.
Right, meaning they looked up his bibliography.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's not what we're talking about. All right, so how many actually use it to determine how well his work was cited? So you got to get that. That's one of the very first things. I mean, 50% of the people I've heard say we use the SCI. You see studies that are done all over the place. Oh, we looked it up, yeah. They mean that they just simply found out what he published. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, then the next step a lot of them take. You say, oh, well, he published. What did he publish in? Not how well was it cited. He published in high-impact or low-impact journals. That's why the journal impact factor is today the most pervasive thing I've ever seen. There are articles published literally approximately every week or two involving impact factors. Discussion of it, good, bad, indifferent, whatever. All over the place. I can run you a list of articles every year. There's probably 50 articles a year on impact factor. Why? Because they're using it as a surrogate for an actual lookup of the true citation counts. Now, third artifact is that because our indexes only list the first author in the citation index, a huge number of people have this ridiculous impression that you can only, that only people get credit for first author, which is nonsense. You go and you look up the paper and you look up the first author's name, but you're getting the citation count for anybody who was an author. Well, that's another part of it. So, today, if you go into the Web of Science, they have all the authors listed. I mean, in other words, you go in, your papers will be listed as well as your co-author's name when you go in there. I mean, you don't see the other name. You simply, well, you do see the other name, but it's got dotted lines, you know it's a secondary author entry.
Most folks say, in my experience, is they're using it to see how many times was he cited. The problem is they then use that as a just a cumulative kind of count instead of them looking at, well, in what journals was he cited.
Well, of course, if you're talking about people in the field of information science and you say you look up somebody's analysis, you're kind of using the data in a restricted context. So how bad is it going to be? Because you're not trying to compare this person to a biochemist, right? I mean, somebody gets cited 100 times a year in the field of information science, that's superstar.
Yeah, right,
okay?
Right.
Whereas in biochemistry, that's normal. Okay?
Yeah,
so, I mean, you don't have to be a genius to know that if you go and look at a listing of all the people that are cited in our field, and you see Jerry Slalton way at the top, everybody knows that his work has got a pervasive influence.
Well, our problem is, in our field, you've got to go not only to Science Citation Index, Social Science Citation Index, and to some extent, Humanities Citation
Index. Yeah, well, it's all combined in one now.
Oh, is it? So you can do that? Oh, good. I've got to give that a try.
Yeah, it's all.
You sort of launched the citation studies industry.
That's probably true.
Science Citation Index. So the bibliometrics, scientometrics.
The bibliometrics and scientometrics.
Yeah. All those things. Talk about these ideas, how they began to occur to you, and then some of them ending up with being products.
Well,
what's your favorite one?
What do you mean, favorite one?
Favorite way to look at the whole.
Well, first of all, in the 55 paper, I did say, not with any deep thought about it, that you probably could use citation indexes for looking at the impact of individuals. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
There was no reference in there to journal impact. It was only later, when we finally got started with the project, that I began to realize that journal impact was something. That's when we had a journal citation index. It was a derivative of what we did on the project.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now then, it was very early on, though, within a year after we published the first
citation indexes. Warren Hagstrom already did a major study using our data. Now, what was I thinking, and Irv and I thinking all in the meantime? Well, by the time we had done the genetics index, I mean,